We actually launched the Climate Discussion Nexus back in 2018. I can't believe it's been 6 years already. And I've been watching the climate debate as well as participating in it, and there are a couple of things that I've noticed. One of them is positive, others not so much. The positive one is that this supposed 97% consensus among scientists, that used to be used to just try to shut everybody up. I've heard a lot less of that recently. And I think people have come to understand that the surveys that supposedly generated that number weren't statistically robust. And also, I think they've just noticed that there are far too many people speaking out who are climate scientists by any rational measure who do dispute that there's a man-made crisis. So that's a good thing. On the negative side, it seems to me that, particularly among policymakers, there's less and less interest in evidence of any sort. They'll tell you, oh, the weather's getting worse, we all know it, proves we're wrecking the climate. And if you go and you dig up the historical data on things like hurricanes or flooding or any number of these, you discover that the weather's not actually getting worse. Wherever we have good records, we see that they're getting better or they're not changing, that there's just a bunch of random fluctuation. It seems to me that the alarmists are rather tearing away from the facts, and it's curious. They often describe themselves as being into evidence-based decision-making, but they have less and less interest in the actual evidence. And it gets harder and harder to bring rationality into the debate when they say hurricanes are getting worse, and you say, no, they're not, and they say, oh, which oil company funds you? That really isn't how science is done. One discouraging thing about the debate on climate change, and not just climate change, public policy tends to be this way, is that it's notoriously angry and polarized. And honestly, in the years that I've been watching public policy generally, I think that the tone has gone downhill, and that took some doing, in a whole lot of areas. But a number of people have said that one thing they like about the videos is that we have this lighthearted and humorous tone. And that's important for a number of reasons, and the first of these, as I frequently quote G.K. Chesterton, the opposite of funny isn't serious, it's not funny. In fact, humor is very often a way of getting to the heart of a matter by showing the meaning of strange juxtapositions, by cutting through a whole bunch of complexities to get to the core of it. But also, we think that anger is like fire. You know, it's a useful servant, but it's a terrible master. There are things that rightly make you indignant. But when it comes time to fix things, you want to be positive. You want to be hopeful. And I'd also add here, my mother taught history at the University of Toronto. And I remember when I was quite young, she said to me that she tried to make her lectures entertaining for two reasons. One was this practical one, that people remember things better if they laugh while hearing them. But the other one, she said, I'm taking an hour of people's lives that they can never get back, and so they really ought to enjoy it. And so that's also this sort of moral obligation to the audience, not to be grim and dismal and grind them down. But more than that, it's to do with this overall idea, again, that I frequently express in other forums, that I'm not really optimistic. Optimism is a psychological condition and generally fatuous, but I am hopeful. That's a theological virtue. If we believe that we really can solve our public policy problems, that despite everything, including the insults and the idiocy, we really can make democracy work and bring about better public policy, then we should be energized and excited about the challenge. We shouldn't be bitter about it. We should have some fun doing it. You know, as they say, life is short. If you're going to get engaged in this stuff, do it because you have a calling for it and because you like making it go well. And that's certainly what we try and do at CDN. We get a lot of comments in our videos, most of them positive, I'm happy to say, and we really appreciate that. As for the negative ones, if they're intelligent criticisms, we're happy to engage with people. We are trying to start a debate. If we're dealing with someone who's mistaken abuse for argument, we don't have much time for them. And that's true, by the way, also of supportive comments, if they seem to be insulting, and we also do not tolerate vulgarity. But in terms of what we bring to the discussion, there are several things that I think are important, and one of them is, we never say something just for effect. We try to say things effectively, but when we make a point, we make it because we think it's true and relevant. Also, we never underestimate the intelligence of our audience. This is an important discussion. We're talking to engaged citizens. We're trying to reach out to policymakers. We include academics in the debate. What we're trying to do here is improve the quality of the debate, to think more sensibly about the science, and to make better policy. And we trust in self-government. We actually did a video on the question of why you don't just leave it to the experts. I'm a historian by training, and sometimes people say, oh, you're not a climate scientist. And my response first is, the essence of historical inquiry is to look at the past to help you understand the present. And that's actually precisely what scientists do. When they do experiments, it's to say, well, if this happened over and over again when we tried it before, it will probably happen in much the same way again. But we also believe that the whole system of democracy, representative self-government, depends critically on the notion that the ordinary person, the untrained expert citizen, can make reasonable judgments about budgeting, about defense policy, about housing policy, about the thousand things that get debated in public affairs. And we include climate in that. We say, yes, the layperson can understand the science. They can understand the economics. They can understand the policy. And we talk to them like grown-ups, and we ask them to do the same. And the response has been enormously gratifying. It's been a very interesting and enjoyable journey here at CDN, including the weird world of the internet. And in fact, when we first started out, we thought that the newsletter would be the main thing that interested people, and then we would do periodic videos to illuminate some of the things that we've been talking about. But as a matter of fact, we got a much better response from the videos, and we follow the military principle that you reward success, not failure. And when we release videos, we're never quite sure what's going to happen. We actually, the first year, we did not get a whole lot of views, but if at first you don't succeed, try again. And suddenly, we went viral, and we picked up something like 1 million views in a month, primarily on our video on the 97% consensus myth, which has had over 1 million views just by itself by now. And so sometimes I'm going to release a video and I'm thinking, this one's a blockbuster. This is really important. This goes to the heart of the debate. This revolutionizes it in some way. And then people watch and go, yeah, okay, thanks. What's next? And other times we'll put out a video thinking, yes, it's true. Yes, it's relevant, but there's nothing all that special here. And suddenly it's got 100,000 or 200,000 views. And so the lesson I think is keep doing what you do well. Believe in what you're doing, work hard at it, never, ever, ever say something just for effect, just say what you think is true, and over the long run, you will get an audience, but you'll never know from week to week how this one's going to do. Years ago, I worked on the editorial board at the Ottawa Citizen. I'd wanted to get into journalism, and I'd managed to do it. And when I got there, I quickly came to the conclusion that the paper was like this 800-pound gorilla. You'd get there in the morning, and it was rattling the bars of the cage, demanding bananas in large quantities. And you'd go out, and you'd find content, and you'd write frantically. You'd finally file it, just making your deadline. You'd stagger home and collapse. You'd get in the next morning, and there it was again, famished and shaking the cage. And this is also true on the climate debate, though there are a lot of bananas. One of the things that happens every week, I'm gathering items that I might use, and they just keep pouring in. And at some point, the difficulty becomes, okay, from all the things that could be said and should be said, which one matters most? And as it was at the newspaper, some of it is, okay, which one's topical? What has just erupted? Often it's, what unbelievable fatuity has some politician or activist just spouted? But other times, this has come up again and again. I keep seeing items on this week after week, and we really need to have a bit of an in-depth look at it. And other times it is because, you know, so soon old, so late smart, I'll be looking at the issue and I'll suddenly think of something that somehow I hadn't before. And one example of this that came to me a couple of months ago when I was reading about climate change causing temperatures to rise and climate change causing the oceans to rise and climate change causing more rain and less rain and all these kinds of things. I suddenly thought, wait a minute, climate is the long-term condition of the weather in some place. So if temperature rises or the seas rise or ice melts. That ought to be an example of climate change, not something caused by climate change. And I got more and more the sense that to many alarmists, climate change is this invisible but mighty beast that lurks out there and causes damage in these areas and causes there to be more wildfires. And I thought, this is the wrong way of thinking about it. I need to do something on that. So I remember I had a journalistic colleague, another columnist at The Citizen, very different views than mine on many issues, but, you know, we were both trying to feed the gorilla. And he said, there are mornings when I come in here and I am just in despair. I don't know what I'm going to write about. I pick up the paper and some incredible piece of foolishness confronts me. And he said, I call that room service. And, you know, if you keep an open mind and a cheerful attitude, you discover that when it's time to write, the world will give you something to write about. There's so much going on, and so much of it, to be honest, deserves the knucklebone shampoo. But again, we also try to think, well, what are our viewers wondering? And we get letters from people saying, gee, could you try and explain this? I'm puzzled by that. Or, oh, people keep saying this and I wonder how to answer it. So it comes in from all kinds of areas. And that's one of the things, to be honest, that makes the job a lot of fun. There is one more thing I should mention about a change in the public debate. For decades, it's been essentially free to express enthusiasm for combating climate change because it was all some distance down the road. But with alarmism forever telling us the crisis is more and more urgent, more and more policies are starting to affect people's lives. The price of energy is going up. The reliability of energy is going down. Taxes are going up. They're really feeling an impact, and yet they're not seeing a change in the weather. And when they look into things like, well, did greenhouse gas emissions actually decline in your country? Generally, the answer is no, they didn't. And so I think people are less and less willing just to say, yeah, sure, whatever, and move on. They're realizing that this stuff really does have a cost. And I think that this is going to become more and more serious as we get closer and closer to the 2030 deadline, for instance, for the Paris Accord targets. One of the weird things about the Paris Accords is that the same computer models that the alarmists used to say, we have to make this deal, said that if everybody hit their targets, it would change global temperature in the year 2100 by about a tenth of a degree, which isn't really worth sacrificing for now, is it? And so I think that you're going to see two things. One is that the anger at these policies is going to increase, and this will probably help elect parties that either don't pledge to fight climate change or quite clearly don't really mean it. But also that people are going to dig deeper into questions like, well, how much has the weather changed? How bad is it if it gets a bit warmer? And I think this may actually help, that we'll get even more sensible attention to some of the unsound assumptions behind the whole climate scare. A critical point about the climate debate is the role of the supposed experts. And I'll tell you that partly because I have worked as a journalist for years, I'm always very skeptical of a headline saying, experts say. What it means is that the reporter found somebody somewhere who agrees with their point of view and has an academic job and then quoted them 9 times out of 10. And you're thinking to yourself, nobody ever heard of this person before. They're at the University of North, South, East, West Dakota and the sociology department. How are they the expert that you really have to listen to? But one of the groups that they often point to is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is part of the United Nations. And apparently that's meant to give it more credibility, though I'm not really a huge fan of the United Nations. But the IPCC does do some good scientific work. And one of the things that we keep pointing out is that if you look at the scientific work, not the summary for policymakers, which is actually edited by the policymakers to say what they want it to say, you look at the actual scientific stuff, and it isn't nearly as scary as activist rhetoric, including that from the UN Secretary General. So when it comes to following the science, you have to be aware of people who wave their arms about and say, oh, the IPCC this and the IPCC that, when they haven't even read the report and quite possibly wouldn't understand it if they did. The science on climate change is actually very, very uncertain. It involves nonlinear algebra. It involves long chains of hypothetical assumptions about feedback mechanisms that nobody can really measure. And a lot of the people in the IPCC's scientific bodies actually admit that and say, well, we haven't found a connection, we don't see anything, we're worried that maybe it'll happen. So yes, do follow the science, but beware of the science and beware of experts say. as I think is true of any job, when you're involved in the details and you're racing to meet a deadline, you've got this you've got to do, you've got that you've got to do, and you're doing your best, but when it's done, you're sometimes not quite certain, well, how good was that? And again, when we release a video, we're never quite sure how it's going to do. But based on the response, we have managed to maintain a very high standard, and there are some that I'm especially pleased with. And to some extent, that is based on the public response. For instance, we knew the 97% consensus myth was an important thing to address, and we knew it was a bit tricky because it involves, to some degree, these surveys that were done of scientists that are statistically bogus. So that means we have to get into the math. Oh boy, what fun. But that video alone has had over 1 million views, and this tells me that it was something people cared about and that we addressed it effectively, that we said what had to be said, and we said it in a way that made it make sense. So that's always very gratifying. There's also my video on A Historian Looks at Climate Change, where a number of people had objected that a historian shouldn't look at climate change, and I wanted to explain why I thought that wasn't right, that history is really the essential basic inquiry. I mean, that's what history originally means. Science used to be called natural history, because it's all about looking for patterns in the past to tell us what is likely to happen in the future and what other method have we got. So I like that one. It's always nice when you see one of the readouts that gets 50,000 or 100,000 views, because you know, yes, we did manage in that one to say something that mattered in a way that resonated. So this to me is very gratifying. I also like looking back, because it has been 6 years now, we have done hundreds of videos and we've covered a lot of things that matter, including we did an early one on the simple physics slogan, explaining that the physics isn't simple. The fact that, yes, CO2 is transparent to incoming visible and ultraviolet light, but then it does tend to absorb and scatter outgoing infrared, and that affects its ability to pass straight back out into space, but that's not the whole story, that it's enormously more complicated. That we said that, we got it on the record, and it helps people build their understanding. Because it's not any one video that's going to change the debate. It's continually addressing an audience that is hungry for facts and knowledge. And, you know, very often they're busy with other jobs and lives. They can't be full-time researchers. But we can get them what they need in a form that works for them. And then the one we did, there's that famous stripes graphic that alarmists like so much. You get it on towels and mouse pads and mugs and everything. But it starts at the depths of the Little Ice Age, and that is a very tendentious starting point. So we did our own stripes video in which we showed what that graphic looks like if you start 2,000 years ago. What happens if you start 12,000 years ago? What happens if you start 500 million years ago? And I really like the ones where we bring history to bear, because this to me is the most important evidence there is. But we're always interested in what you think we should do videos on. We are, again, so grateful that we have this audience. It proves that what we're doing is worthwhile. The customer is king, and we would like to hear from you. Given what we've done already and how well it's gone, what do you want to see us do next? Because it's been a great 6 years, and we're only looking forward to more and better in the years to come.